morning. I'm Michael Cathcart, and you're very welcome to a gleaming new week of Books and Arts. Today you'll meet an astonishing Glaswegian performer named Claire Cunningham. Her dance performances incorporate the crutches she's used since she was 14.
To go into dance then, which is a medium that is entirely about the body and is giving people very specifically permission to look at your body and specifically how it moves, was a huge, you know, it's a cliche, but it was the emotional roller coaster.
And we find out what it's like to be a contemporary artist in Vietnam.
There is no official governmental support for the practice of contemporary art. So the artists have been very engaging in helping each other to do exhibitions, to do educational talks, to connect to different organisations and work with them and collaborate with them.
And you'll discover four new Aussie plays written by four Australian women. It's nice to be with you this morning on Books and Arts. Well, the news is in this morning from the British Academy and Film Awards, the BAFTAs, where one Aussie has cleaned up and another has gone home empty-handed. Our first leading film, which is not about Australians at all, The Revenant, which stars Leonardo DiCaprio, directed by Alejandro González, what's his name? Iñárritu. Is that it? Iñárritu dominated this year's BAFTA ceremony, taking out Best Actor. Leonardo DiCaprio got Best Actor, Best Director, and the Best Film Award, the most prestigious award of all. Now, the Australian who did well is Mad Max, Fury of the Road, by the Australian director George Miller. He'd won four awards, all in the technical areas, Best Makeup and Hair, Best Editing, and Best Costume Design, and one other. The Best British Film was Brooklyn, and we'll be covering that one here on Books and Arts next week. And also Best Original Screenplay, that one went to Spotlight, which is based on a true story of a newspaper investigation into sexual abuse inside the Catholic Church in the US of A. Well, the big disappointment from an Australian point of view is the Australian actress Cate Blanchett. There were big hopes for the film Carol, directed by Todd Haynes. It was nominated for lots of awards, including Best Actress and Best Makeup and Best Cinematography. It didn't win anything. Anyway, congratulations to all of the winners. Just head to our Facebook page where you'll find a full list. On our end, this is Books and Arts. Now to some Aussie theatre.
Drive to a house in Preston. We see police arresting a man with his hand in a bag. How's that for first impressions? This place seems depressing. It's a Californian bungalow in a cul-de-sac.
See, that's what I think of as a classy rhyme, rhyming Preston with police arresting. If you lived in Preston, you might be quite cross. That's Courtney Barnett with that lovely Aussie accent of hers, with her ode to the Melbourne northern suburbs, De Preston, that song's called. Over the coming weeks, the Melbourne Theatre Company is hosting readings of four new Australian plays, and they're the fruit of the MTC's Cybeck Electric Play Reading Series. And the man putting this all together is the MTC's Literary Director, Chris Mead. Good morning.
Good morning, Michael.
Happy New Year to you.
And to you too.
Our first conversation for the year. And also with us is one of the playwrights, Bridget Mackey. Hi, Bridget.
Hello.
You're
Hi.
In,
you, you're... you know, I live in Preston.
Oh, you live in Preston, do you?
Yes.
Have you ever seen police arresting?
I have, yeah.
Have you ever seen a man with his hand in a bag doing something a bit shifty?
Yeah, I can see Centrelink from my house.
See, now that's a lyric. I can see Centrelink from my house. Sometimes it's bad, sometimes it's grouse.
Hey.
What does a literary manager do, or literary director do, Chris?
I've got a fantastic job because no one's really sure what my job is. So the fun part of it is that no one's quite sure where I am, but that's because I'm everywhere, Michael. I get the chance to think about the repertoire the company does, and that means thinking about all of the theatrical works in the canon, such as it is, but also I'm kind of the interface between the company and playwrights. I do a lot of research on plays and also make recommendations about the program that we have.
Now, most big theatre companies have a literary manager who basically reads a lot.
That's exactly it. Usually, if I'm not in rehearsal, I'm reading a play.
Yeah. So you are the person who knows most probably about the playwriting scene, because you know all the plays that get done, but you know all the ones that don't get done.
Yeah, it's full of heartbreak. ambition, that's what it's about.
Does that mean you're the man who has to deliver the bad news, are you?
Yes.
Oh.
Yeah, I'm loved and loathed, I suppose.
Well, you're obviously loving him, Bridget.
Yes.
Because he's put you in his program. Yep. So this is the Cybeck Electric Program. Actually, Chris, you better tell us what the overall brief here is on the Cybeck Electric Program. Cybeck's a company, is it, or a foundation?
It's a foundation. So we're very lucky to be supported by Roger Reardon. He's a lovely, lovely, generous man who was very successful later in life and supports a lot of young mums and a lot of young artists, at young composers as well as playwrights. And he's passionate about that gap between finishing your degree or finishing kind of being young and being old, somewhere in the middle there. How on earth do you find your feet as a professional? And so he has this program, or we've crafted this program with him, to find artists who are at that difficult time of they've made a lot of work at the independent or fringe level, and how on earth do they find their way to the main stages?
And partly I reckon that's about writing at scale.
That's exactly right. And it's a very hard thing to find the rhythm of, to find the kind of dimensions of, I suppose.
Have you found that, Bridget? I mean, once we start out in theatre, you know, we all work in little spaces and we talk about the strong points of the intimate space where we're working to an audience of, say, 90 people, and suddenly you want your actors talking in big voices. It's kind of weird. Suddenly they're going to talk extremely loudly to each other so they can fill a big space. And directors and writers, I think, find it hard to visualise their space working with intimacy, but at scale. Bridget, are you finding that?
Yeah, it definitely requires different skills, but that's why programs like Cybeck are really important, and that we can continue to grow our skills.
How did you get involved?
The space.
How did you get involved in this, Bridget?
I was a dramaturg intern on Cybeck a couple of years ago.
That's a hard thing to say. A dramaturg intern.
Yep. and have done an internship through Playwriting Australia. So I was working with Chris Mead with Chris with that. So it was around, but Chris sort of liked an idea I had, so
he was encouraging.
Yeah.
Encouraging. Well, she's also a graduate of, she's been very humble. She's had a number of plays around Melbourne in different small spaces and went through the VCA doing the playwriting
course.
So what
did you see in Bridget's work that made you think, yeah, this could work in a big theatre?
What I love about Bridget's work, and in fact all of the playwrights in this program, is there's a ferocity to the writing. There's a great dexterity, there's a sinuousness, and they're interested in thrilling an audience, but doing so from slightly different angles, I suppose. And what we can do in Cybeck is put writers with great skill and talent in front of an audience, because I firmly believe that playwrights learn best when they're sitting in that audience watching their work.
Ferocity, Bridget, is that a word you can own?
Yeah, I think so.
You don't sound ferocious. You sound really nice. I should say I'm not looking at Bridget. She's in our Adelaide studio. So all I've got to go on is what you've got to go on, which is her friendly voice. But apparently you're really, despite this voice, ferocious.
Well, maybe. My characters are ferocious.
Are they? So the play is called The Exact Dimensions of Hell. Well, that's a ferocious sounding title. What's it about?
It's about a woman who was abused by a cult leader when she was a teenager, and it's about her efforts to keep him in prison.
And how old is she now?
She's in her late 20s.
And what made you want to target cults? Have you had some experience of this, or did you encounter them in some way?
No, not personally. I think what really interests me is a number of cases I've been reading about where the abuse by the cult leader is tied up in the religious practice of the cult, so it can be justified in this really, you know, the perpetrator can justify their abuse.
You mean the cult leader is able to say to a member of the cult, because you're special and because I have these powers, we're going to form this intimate relationship, which might seem a little bit funny or creepy, but really it will bring you spiritual delights or spiritual enrichment of a kind you've never dreamed of.
Exactly, like a teacher does, or a psychotherapist, or anyone you have an intimate relationship with.
Right.
And what fascinated me about this piece was the way that Bridget unsparingly looked at that very difficult line between the quest for meaning, yearning for something significant and wanting to make something of one's life. And so of course one looks for gurus, one looks for an elder who knows better, and what's so terrifying is how you navigate that with any semblance of honesty.
This is Books and Arts on RN, and we're talking about one of four plays that are part of a series on at the Melbourne Theatre Company called the Cybeck Electric Play Reading Series. Chris Mead is with me. He's the literary director at the MTC, and he's putting all this together. And one of the playwrights who's represented is Bridget Mackie, who's in our Adelaide studios. So what separates a cult from other forms of intense religious practice or observance?
Well, it's really the number of people involved, I guess, how established it is. I read a statistic that there's like 3,000 cults in Australia, apparently.
But you can see what I'm asking. I mean, there are all sorts of people who meditate. There are all sorts of people who are very devoted to a guru, for example. When does it become cultish in your view?
In my view, it's probably when there's an abuse of power. It's when it's dangerous. I mean,
A cult is by definition abusive in your term. In your terms, it's a pejorative term. Cult, I suppose, it is a pejorative term.
I think yes, but that's just. But there, I don't think that every cult that exists is abusive. And I think one of the reasons why I'm interested in writing about this subject matter is because I actually think spirituality is important, and there's something to be found there. I'm definitely not anti-cults. I'm looking at the complexity of why people would be compelled to join one.
Yeah. And are you writing this because you're on some kind of spiritual quest yourself? Are you looking for a way through for yourself to the ineffable, or do you know someone who was hurt? What's the driver in your guts that made you sit down and write this play? Because no one writes a play offhandedly.
There were a couple of cases that, a few cases I read about that did just hit me in the guts, and I thought, it's the complexity of the people who are involved in these cases that really interest me.
And also
because I think we all have a capacity to want to have the answers. I think we all have the capacity to hurt other people, to excuse bad behaviour. So,
So this is a powerful premise for a play, Chris. I mean, we often think about plays as ideal when they're entertaining, but actually when we go to the theatre, we want some kind of meat and potatoes. Unless we're vegetarians, in which case we just want potatoes.
What's also fun about the way that Bridget's written this is that the question of who is telling the truth is up for grabs the entire play. So she could be lying. The cop she's talking to, who's helping her, he could be lying. And the woman who they're trying to extract the information from, who was also in the cult but was a grown-up when this woman was a girl. So there's three people in the play. So we're never quite sure who's telling the truth. And there's nothing wrong with wanting to meet up with like-minded individuals to pursue a particular goal. But this fella has gone to prison for fraud, and
right,
they're trying to keep him there. And it's thrilling, and it's not common that playwrights use a thriller genre, but it's exciting when it happens.
And a lie is a very powerful dimension in a play, isn't it? Especially if the audience suspects there's a lie or knows there's a lie, and the characters on stage don't know there's a lie.
That's exactly it.
There's a lot of drama There's a lot of drama to be had from that. Now, one of the other shows that I know you're enthusiastic about is called The Day I Left Home. What's this?
Well, since we started at Melbourne Theatre Company, we were looking at issues of institutional racism as well as institutional sexism, and we've had a women directors program and then a women in theatre program, but we also had MTC Connect, which is a way for people who work in the company like me to talk to a number of different community groups, theatre groups who may not ordinarily come into South Bank, may not ordinarily write a play and expect to see it on the main stages. So it's a combination of directors, writers and actors. And somebody in that group was Rashma Kalsi, who is a playwright, who's a trained playwright, who's written a lot in India and divides her time between Delhi and Australia. And she sent me a number of plays and we started a kind of year or two long dialogue about what kind of plays does the main stage want? You know, what should she be writing? Which, of course, is an impossible question to answer.
Well, the main stage in Australia.
Correct. So this play is the fruit of those conversations, I suppose. And what fascinated her was the way that so many Australians have so little understanding of the scale of India. When we talk about an Indian person, you know, we're forgetting the fact that they speak so many different languages. It's huge geographically, and there's also class to consider as well. So she's written a play for three different characters, each from a different class, each a different age, and each from a different part of India with no common language other than English.
So you've got four female playwrights, and you've got a Melbourne focus, and it's a Melbourne theatre company.
Mm-hmm.
Is that by design?
I was lucky, I suppose, that people are really interested in what's going on here right now. And I would suggest, I would argue that often the most specific of plays can be the most universal.
Now, Chris, the Melbourne Theatre Company has a reputation for being conservative in its programming because it has this conservative subscriber base. At the heart of it are these, you know, middle-class people who, you know, live in Camberwell and like to drive to the theatre and park under the building and so on. And it comes in for some flack because it doesn't reflect the wider Australian culture, particularly the Melbourne culture, which is so diverse. Now, I'm putting you in an odd spot here because you work for the organisation, but you are programming more diversity at the edges of the Melbourne Theatre Company, as it were. Do you see this as a conduit into the main program for a more diverse program, or will the subscribers in the end always call the shots and make it difficult to achieve the kind of diversity that certainly I would like to see there?
I think that, well, two things. Firstly, you've absolutely spotted it. The reason that this CyBeck program is here is to absolutely feed the main stage. We've got to give people an opportunity in front of an audience, as I said, but also we want to think about what MTC should, could, might be programming next year. So we put these plays on now, and we love people to come because plays only exist with an audience. And about that audience, our subscribers, we're so lucky, you know, that we've got such a terrific and surprisingly diverse group of people who come into the theatre. And it's one of those conversations we have in theatre all the time about, are we just reactive or how do we lead? And I think that we're absolutely desperate to get on the front foot and to think about diversity in all its different guises, whether it's the, you know, from anyone who walks down the street, we'd love them to come. It seems like a kind of effete or perhaps, you know, not a main part of what one does in one's life. And yet in so many cultures, yeah, theatre is central. And, you know, you go back to the Natyashastra, an ancient Sanskrit text, and the question it asks of any play is, it has to be about now. Is it about now? It should damn well be about now. And we can ask any question we
ironic
want.
Ironic that your authority for that proposition is so ancient, written in a dead language. But lovely as always, Chris. These are readings, we should say.
Yes.
These are readings, yeah. Thank you for coming. And thanks to you too, Bridget.
You're welcome. Thank you.
It's been lovely to meet you. Chris Mead is the curator of the Melbourne Theatre Company's Cyber Electric Play Reading Series. He's the literary director at the MTC. And Bridget Mackey is one of the playwrights who you can hear in this program. If you're in Melbourne, the reading of her new play, The Exact Dimensions of Hell, is on the 3rd and the 5th of March, and all the other readings you can find out about by going to our website. I'm Michael Cathcart, and this is Books and Arts.
Would you care to sit with me for a cup of English tea? Very twee, very me, any sunny morning. What a pleasure it would be.
chatting so delightfully. Now it's time to meet the acclaimed Scottish performer Claire Cunningham. Claire has osteoporosis and has walked with crutches since she was 14 years old. Her dance performances are like nothing, well, nothing I've ever seen, and probably nothing you've ever seen either. She uses those crutches to move and to dance. Her one-man show is called, or one-woman show, is called Guide Gods, and it's one of the headline events at the Perth International Arts Festival, which is about to descend upon us, and it explores the themes of religion and disability using movement, storytelling, and tea. Claire Cunningham is speaking to Claire Nichols in Perth.
Can you tell me about the relationship you have with your crutches?
Well, I guess it's relationship is a really good word for it. It's a connection that's kind of changed over the course of my life. I started using them when I was 14 and I really hated them. My shin bones started to fracture at that age. So I was using them just as anybody that might kind of break a leg or whatever would use them, and kind of imagined that it was quite a sort of short term situation, and kind of kept myself in that slightly deluded frame of mind for a long time, actually. And yeah, as a teenager, I didn't like them, and they were just an object, and they kind of were very loaded with a lot of negative implications. And then it was interesting that kind of I think I was about 27 when I first kind of encountered working in dance, very surprisingly, and that really turned a lot of that situation on its head, and that relationship changed a lot to them suddenly opening up a whole range of possibilities for ways of moving. I then became kind of fascinated by them, very geekily sort of curious about them as objects, and then that really shifted into beginning to really love them, actually, and then an acceptance of, oh, actually, this is a relationship. Actually, it's like a partner, almost, in a lot of ways. There's a dependency there between both of us. You know, they don't really have a function without me, and I don't function very well without them. So, yeah, it's really changed from kind of hate to love.
It is beautiful watching you perform with them. It gives you this graceful, this almost weightless quality as you move using those crutches. For those who haven't had the pleasure of seeing you perform, can you describe the way you work with those crutches on stage?
Yeah, I flip between two sort of modes, I think, with my crutches, in that they're either an object very much that I work with separately, and I've done performances where they very much become a separate object and I build with them. I turn them into other things. I've turned them into crowns or a big hanging mobile, and building with them and kind of showing the beauty of the object and how they fascinate me in that way. So they either kind of exist in that way, and then the other side of that is that they do become at times like sort of organic extensions of the body, which is a way... People used to say that to me very early on when I started dancing, but I didn't really get it. I didn't really agree with it, but I realise in more recent years that they absolutely now have that organic connection to me, and that I do feel through them to a degree. Because I've used them so long, I guess the comparison for me is something like a juggler in the circus. I have a very, very specific tuning to these objects and how much they weigh, where the balance points are, so I can manipulate them and play with them. Yeah, in a very sort of, for want of a better term, quite virtuosic way, because I've used them for so long.
You came to dance quite late. I believe you started as a classical singer. Can you tell me a bit about that transition?
Yeah, I always was drawn to singing. And if I'm honest, it's still in my soul is probably the most natural art form for me. But yeah, it's that difficulty with, as when I, although I studied classical singing, I was prepped through university to actually do the singing, but they don't really teach you how to make a living. They don't teach you how to actually go out and work. And I didn't know how to work in the industry when I came out of university as a singer. And so I did some work in musical theatre and got a lot of basic stagecraft, but I wasn't earning a living as a singer, so I began to look at how can I expand my skills. And through a whole very long story, kind of accidentally found myself in dance, to my own surprise, more than anybody else's, I think, even. It was quite a sort of shocking twist, really, to go from partly also the thing about singing had been I was still coming from a place of discomfort with my own body and how I looked as a disabled person. I was still very, very uncomfortable with that. And to go into dance then, which is a medium that is entirely about the body and is giving people very specifically permission to look at your body and specifically how it moves, was a huge, you know, it's a cliche, but it was the emotional roller coaster. But yeah, it's been an extraordinary journey, and it's, yeah, the right journey. It's changed everything in my life for the better, for sure.
I saw Guide Gods last night, and before we get into the themes of the show, I want to talk about what happened right at the start, which is what we entered the space and we were asked to take our shoes off. And for me, it was the most disarming way to start a show. What was the thinking behind getting people to do that?
So the show is exploring the perspective of different faiths and religions towards disability. And obviously within certain religions, there is the ritual of taking off your shoes as you go into the place of worship. So there's obviously that very literal connection. But I think there is something about this notion of vulnerability a little bit. And I think this thing as well for me of equalising people in the space. I think when people are required to have to kind of take a little bit more care and pay, maybe people become a little bit more sensitive to the ground that they walk on, or they look where they're going a little bit more. And I think that's my experience in the world as someone who uses crutches. I look at the ground all the time. I'm very, very tuned into having to watch the ground for kind of risk or slippage, you know, danger. So I think there's a bit of that, of kind of equalising myself with the audience as well, of going, if I make you take your shoes off, you have to slow down, you have to be a bit quieter and pay attention. What was really funny last night, people came in and took their shoes off, and it took about 5 minutes in total to get everybody's shoes off. And in Scotland, it took about 20 minutes because everybody's turning up in their big winter boots that take forever to unlace. And, you know, there's no place to put them. Whereas last night, everyone turns up in like sandals and flip flops, and it's like, whoop, off, gone. It was like, wow, okay, this is good. So we started the show much more on time than we do in Scotland.
Your show uses recorded interviews with people of different faiths talking about faith and disability. What did you learn from talking to those people about how they related to their disability?
There was different perspectives, and I mean, the show really tries to be hopefully very honest about it. It's just the perspectives of the people that I spoke to. It doesn't claim to be this is how Islam views disability, or this is how Buddhism views it. It's this is how this person who is a Muslim and is disabled, this is their experience, and this is this person who is Buddhist, and this is this person who's a post-atheist agnostic views it. So it's very... Hopefully people understand that it's not trying to make sweeping generalizations about anything. I mean, I think, yeah, it was really fascinating to hear the different perspectives. We had one woman who was a Muslim who felt that for her, she viewed disability as a test, as part of her life through Islam, that disability was a test for her in terms of how she dealt with situations and how she dealt with people's attitudes. The conversation that triggered the show was a man who was physically impaired who viewed his disability through the lens of karma. And it's interesting because, yeah, I think more than anything, what it does is it highlights my own prejudices or my own preconceptions more than anything. It highlights my own ignorance. When somebody tells me, you know, I think it's a test, I think, oh, and I get an emotional reaction maybe to that, whether I agree or I disagree. And I think what is most exciting then is to And most important is then to go, well, why do I feel that? Why does it trigger that in me? We might be think we're very liberal and then something comes up and you react to it. And the important thing, I think, is to question why. You know, when I met the man who said his disability was related to karma, I think, yeah, I was a little bit offended because I felt that I was therefore included in that. If he thought that about himself, therefore he must think that about me. And then it's like, well, what does it matter? You know, if you don't believe the same thing, does that matter? Can you respect somebody to have a very different opinion? So, yeah, I think it more than anything, it challenged me to have to kind of notice my reactions to things. And I think hopefully that's maybe a little bit the experience for an audience as well.
Did it change the way you think about your impairment?
I don't think it changed the way that I thought about my own impairment so much as it made me aware of, I think, my own ignorance in other ways, in the sense that I would talk to people perhaps who followed a faith but maybe weren't disabled. And I suddenly realised that I was now in that place of not knowing the language and of being scared to say the wrong thing, which is the experience a lot of non-disabled people have around disability, is a fear of saying the wrong thing, or people being worried about, you know, the people that go, oh, it's political correctness gone mad. I don't agree with that. I think language is hugely important, and it is very important to look for the language that people want to use themselves and to respect that. So I think terminology is important. I don't think it's PC gone mad. I disagree when people go on that. But I realised I was in a situation where I didn't know the correct terminology at times. And I was talking to people who were clearly trying to find the right language around disability to talk to me, and were kind of treading that minefield in talking to me. And I was doing the same back to them, but around religious terminology. So I think that was really fascinating.
Claire, you make a bold proclamation at the start of the show that you have discovered the secret to world peace. Do you care to share that secret with us today?
Yeah, so there's a running theme through the work that I believe potentially that the cure for the means to world peace might just be to sit and have a cup of tea. And this comes entirely out of the fact that this was such a recurring theme with everybody that I spoke to. So all the interviews that I did, whether they were within the show or just surrounding research, everybody offered me a cup of tea. You meet up to talk to it with somebody. Do you want a cup of tea? Ah, yeah, okay. And I actually don't like tea. I'm a coffee drinker. But what I noticed was that, particularly in religious institutions, it's all instant coffee. And I can't stand instant coffee. So I ended up having to drink tea, partly because you're also trying to be polite. But it's an icebreaker. And that these things of like sharing a drink or sharing food are universal sort of things in every culture. So it felt like that was so, it was a thread that ran through everything, and it felt like a really nice way to connect everyone together. So in terms of an audience as well, to be able to share something like that, and then literally to share that as a space at the end of the performance, to be able to go, okay, yeah, let's have a cup of tea and chat, and this is universal. The simplicity of something like that, have a cup of tea and talk to somebody, and creating the space to do that, I think, yeah, I do consider that the time after the show of sitting, having a cup of tea and a chat, whether that's me with members of the audience or members of the audience with each other, I consider that still part of the show and just as essential, and possibly more essential than the show itself.
Claire Cunningham speaking to Claire Nichols in Perth. And if you go on YouTube and look for Claire Cunningham, you'll find some lovely examples of her work, including Claire actually walking on teacups. It's extremely beautiful. Her show is called Guide Gods, and it's part of the Perth International Arts Festival. It runs from Wednesday until Saturday, no, till Sunday this week. But you might have missed out on tickets if you haven't got one already, because it's sold out, I think. I certainly couldn't get a ticket. I was dying to see this one. Anyway, she's got another show called Give Me a Reason to Live, and that one runs in Perth from the 2nd till the 5th of March. I'm Michael Cathcart, and this is RN.
This year's El Niño summer has been a record breaker.
Whether you've splashed through puddles on the soggy east coast, waited in vain for a storm in the north, or endured the burning landscapes of the southern states and WA, we want to hear from you. Tell us about your landscape. How's it changed over this unpredictable summer? Just look for Hot Summer Land on the RN homepage and read fabulous short summer stories from all over the country too.
And on RN, it's time now for Top Shelf. Anthony Penrose is the son of American photographer Lee Miller and surrealist artist Roland Penrose. Anthony grew up in a house surrounded by his parents' famous artist friends, including Picasso and Miro. For our Top Shelf segment, Anthony Penrose chooses some of his favourite artworks.
Hello, my name's Anthony Penrose, and my top shelf picks are, first of all, a book, Periodic Table of the Elements. It's by Primo Levi. He was a Holocaust survivor. He was the most amazing writer, and Periodic Table of the Elements is his work as a scientist. It's all about the elements. And actually, when I read that, it made sense for me of the way the world is put together in a physical sense. And it's a wonderfully inspiring book. My second choice is a movie, and it has to be Schindler's List, because for the fact that I chose Primo Levi will tell you that I've spent a long time studying the Holocaust for various reasons, and I felt that Schindler's List was just an amazingly accurate, heartfelt, moving take on the whole thing. It's the kind of thing which I think is a document in its own right, not so much a feature. It's the way myth elucidates reality, and I think it's so important for our understanding of what happened then. Another somewhat dark event, it's a play called Whose Life Is It Anyway? And when I saw it, it had Tom Conti in the lead. And it's about the right to die. And that affected me very deeply because at that moment, a person in my life was struggling, wanting to die. And the way it was articulated in that play was deeply moving. And of course, it stayed with me ever since. Number four in my choice, and these are, you know, I don't want to put them in order of importance because they're all important to me. I used to follow very closely the work of a dance group called the London Contemporary Dance Theatre, and I got to know a lot of the dancers because my late wife, she was a dancer and a dance teacher, and we just got on with these people so well. They had a choreographer called Robert Cohan, and they did a number of pieces, Stabat Mater, but my most, the waterless method of swimming instruction, I loved that one. And then Forest. For me, it just recreated the whole sense of woodland and the creatures that live in it in this very beautiful piece.
What a rich and wonderful list. The writer Anthony Penrose, and you can hear a conversation between him and Sarah Konofsky on Books and Arts later this week. And his soon-to-be-released children's book is called Miro's Magic Animals, published by Thames and Hudson. Well, now to Vietnam, which is home to more than 90 million people and has one of the fastest-growing economies in the world. But contemporary artists in Vietnam get almost no support from the government. Instead, artist collectives and non-profit arts organisations have stepped in to foster the contemporary art scene in Vietnam. They organise exhibitions and public talks, and they provide artist-in-residency programmes. Georgia Moody takes us to one of these organisations.
I'm standing on the street here in Ho Chi Minh City. It is boiling. I'm sweltering. But that's okay. I'm just about to go inside a beautiful air-conditioned building. The building houses San Art, which is one of Vietnam's preeminent contemporary art spaces. Let's go inside.
My name is Cha. I'm general manager of San Art, an independent art organisation in Vietnam.
How did San Art get started?
It was founded in 2007 by four artists. They were all Vietnamese but have been living and studying overseas. When they came back to Vietnam, they got to encounter the lack of resources for artistic practice in Vietnam. And they all together wanted to help the artists exchange their ideas better and get to work with international practice. So they set up at first a library, a reading room, where they brought all the catalogs or the books on artistic practice all over the world to Saigon. From that, San Art program expanded to exhibitions, educations, where we invited different speakers, artists, curators all over the world to Ho Chi Minh City to again open different doors on artistic practice for the local audience.
What kind of support is there for contemporary artists working in Vietnam?
The artists are actually the most active factor in supporting themselves in doing art. There is no official governmental support for the practice of contemporary art very specifically. So the artists have been very engaging in helping each other to do exhibitions, to do educational talks, to connect to different organizations and work with them and collaborate with them.
So there's no government support at all?
Well, it comes as a surprise to you, doesn't it? But no, I can confirm that there is no support, and if any, very, very little support from the government.
And so San Art is one of the collectives around Vietnam who is stepping into the role of educating and supporting artists working in this country.
We don't see ourselves as someone who take this responsibility from the government. We see that this is necessary, and we go ahead and do it. I personally still think that the government should take a more active step into supporting contemporary art, but when the support is not so apparent yet, organizations like San Art, we help shape the practice in Vietnam.
Tell me about some of the programs that San Art runs.
One of the major programs that we initiated and struggled to continue but still put a lot of effort in is the residency program, in which we have an open call for Southeast Asian artists to submit their proposal. And if they are chosen, they are invited to Ho Chi Minh City for 6 months. They are provided with a place to stay, a studio to practice, and a small fund to realize the project. With this, we are proposing a worry-free environment for emerging artists who we believe would be the driving force of the whole practice, because they are the one who dare to think innovatively, and they are committed to what they do, and we come in providing the facility for that.
Let's meet a few of the current artists in residence here at San Art.
My name is Questel and I'm from Singapore. I studied in LaSalle College of the Arts in Singapore for 4 years, and I was trained in painting, but it was only when I was in year two I decided to change my medium completely. And so now I work with materials, mainly because as a means to sustain my practice, because things are really expensive in Singapore. So it was just something I had to do. So now I work mainly with fabrics and with threads, because they're relatively cheaper in Singapore to get in bulk.
So you've just arrived here in Ho Chi Minh City for the residency?
Yeah, it's been 14 days only.
And what are you hoping to do here at San Art?
What I would like to do is, I mean, mainly to gain a different perspective on the resources that an artist would need to sustain his or her practice. So this is one of the main objectives for me. And at the same time, I would like to create a new body of work that I've been thinking of for a really long time, but I don't have the time and space when I was in Singapore to do that. So I'm hoping that this 6 months would help me to achieve these two things. And hopefully I could try and build a career as an artist.
Can you introduce yourself for me?
I am Dũng. Tôi là Dũng. Tôi là nghệ sĩ tại thành phố Hồ Chí Minh.
Hi, my name is Nguyễn Quốc Dũng. I'm an artist from Ho Chi Minh City, Vietnam, and I graduated from Ho Chi Minh Fine Art University in 2015.
Tôi đến với San Art để tôi làm về tác phẩm.
He came to San Art to practice his oil painting skill. He cares about the worker's life and the life of everyone who is living, including the students, the old people, even the prostitutes. And he usually go to the place where these people live to actually doing research and to take a look at the life of these people.
What role does San Art play in the contemporary art scene here in Ho Chi Minh City?
Tôi nghĩ nó rất quan trọng và nó là một không gian mở để cho những nghệ sĩ.
He thinks that San Art is a very important space because it's an open space for young artists to come here and experience and learning and improving their skills.
I imagine it must be hard being a contemporary artist here in Vietnam. Why have you decided to become an artist?
He wants to challenge himself as well as doing something that he has never done before. And also those are the things that he loves and always wanted to do.
Nguyễn Quốc Dũng and Questel Tay, two of the current artists in residence at San Art. Now, let's meet one of the many established artists that San Art has worked with and supported. His name is Udam Tran Nguyen, and his work is currently on display at the Asia Pacific Triennial at GOMA, the Gallery of Modern Art in Queensland. How does your life here in Ho Chi Minh City feed into your art?
I think Ho Chi Minh City is a very inspiring place because it's very happening. Like many things you see on the street that you think that, oh, it's kind of impossible, but it did happen. And that gives you some ideas. Because I think that art, you know, doesn't really happen much like in a very beautiful environment. But it's more like happening with chaos. And Ho Chi Minh right now, I think it's chaotic. That's why it's a good place for artists to be.
Is the contemporary art scene here in Vietnam similar to the contemporary art scene in other Southeast Asian countries, or is it quite distinct?
I hope it's distinct. But I think we share the same colonial history. Which is important to think about it sometimes. like for Cambodia, they share, you know, they have that history of the Khmer Rouge, which is, I think, is very unique in a way. And Singapore is a, you know, colony of the British at one point. So, you know, Vietnam has gone through a lot too, French, American, and Chinese, and Japanese. So I think we do share that history. And so I think, you know, some of the work based on that history, you can feel that there's a sense of similarity. But then I think every artist, they have a very different way of approaching their, you know, chaotic scenes in their country.
What medium do you use in your art?
I was trained as a sculptor in the socialist system here. And later on, I traveled to America, and I studied there. So I have a interesting background mixture of like an artist, you know, that trained under the communists, and then later under the capitalism, you know, system. So when you came back, you have the idea that, oh, you know, it's not so bad on this side or that side. Both sides have certain thing that would complement, you know, each other. And so, you know, I, from that background, I actually have a lot of hand-on experience with like modeling clay. And at the same time, like I can use like a lot of other equipment like videos or photography or even like web app, you know, application. So right now I'm showing two works in QA Roma. Is one is interactive art with an app, you know, that you can draw from a long distance. So you can sit here in Ho Chi Minh City and draw in APT8. And the other one is a video. So I'm using all kind of medium when it, like if that medium best, you know, express the concept, I would use it. So I don't limit myself to any medium.
Are you excited about what's happening in the contemporary art world here in Vietnam?
Absolutely. I think right now is a very exciting time. Because I came from an artist family, and I've been here until now, it feels like this is the right time. It's like many artists, talented people came back from abroad, and many younger generation here, they are passionate about it. And so it's like a confluence of ideas and energy that makes like the art scene in Vietnam right now, I think, is the best time that anybody can hope for.
The Vietnamese artist U Dam Tran Nguyen speaking there to Georgia Moody in Ho Chi Minh City. And U Dam's work is, as you heard there, on display at the Asia Pacific Triennial, the APT, at GOMA, the Gallery of Modern Art in Queensland. And it's there until the 10th of April. So you can see him drawing in Ho Chi Minh City, and it's all coming up in Brisbane. What an amazing thing. What a wonderful world we live in. And you'll find links to the Triennial and to San Art on our website. And that's today's podcast of Books and Arts. We make this show every weekday, and we post the week's highlights on Saturday afternoons. It's the best in arts talk from Australia and around the world here on podcast whenever you want to listen. And it'd be lovely if you got in touch to tell us where you're listening from. I'd love to know where you are across the world, if you're listening to us far away from Australia or in some remote corner of the country, or even just around the corner from our studio. You can email us by clicking Contact Us at the top of our webpage, or talk to us on Facebook. I'm Michael Cathcart, and this is RN. Bye now.